I'm out. The task force has to do with energy generation potential.
Welcome, everyone, to the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. This is March 31st, 2011, for the record. All right, we're going to start out with Senate Bill 846. Senator Brzezinski, we'll open a public hearing on 846.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Floyd Brzezinski, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Thank you very much for taking up Senate Bill 846. I want to direct your attention to the Dash 4 amendments. That is what I am asking you to consider, not the original bill. Under the Dash 4 is what it basically would say is that a person, i.e. a business that was in manufacturing trailers, by trailers that were intended to be used for human passengers, to affix on the trailer a label that would inform the purchaser of the bike trailer whether it does or doesn't conform to the ASTM international specification. The reason for this bill is to give buyers the knowledge that I believe they should have the right to have as to whether or not the trailer they are purchasing more than likely to transport their children in meets a safety standard. This bill is a result from a constituent contacting me who actually is the owner of Burley Bikes, and his interest came around when there was another bill that was introduced on the House side by Representative Greenlick, which was, let's say, over the top and extreme, saying that kids would not be allowed to ride bicycles that were under 6 years of age. And so, as I told my constituent and many other people, said that bill did not have any opportunity for success to go forward, and we think that even though Representative Greenlick wanted to do what he felt was best for children as it pertains to bicycling, that it was one that did not have the, merit to go forward. You'll notice on the bill itself, myself, Representative Hoyle, as well as a few other people, including Representative Greenlick, has signed on to this bill. The purpose of this bill is really to give information to the buyer, and so the buyer will know whether or not it meets a safety standard. And I believe it's important for those individuals to have that information before they make a purchase so they can rely on and with the knowledge whether or not they feel the trailer that they are going to be transporting their children is actually meets a standard that they would, I think, would assume would already be on the books and enforced. So that's the basis of the bill and the Dash 4 amendments. And if you have any questions, I'll try my best to answer them. I will say this, Mr. Chair, your Vice Chair, Senator Atkinson, as being an accomplished cyclist, will probably be able to give you a lot more insight on this matter as well.
Thank you. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. I got to tell you, this is the first time I've seen the amendments. And I kind of agree with your cause, and I'm not going to argue that. But there is a part in here which is being affixed to a lot of bills that only the prevailing plaintiff gets reasonable cost of attorney fees. I can't go there. I just don't think that that's right. What happens if what happens if someone has a lawsuit that isn't founded on fact and the business, for example, has to go to defend itself? Why can't they get reasonable attorney fees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I actually have no problem with having that go forward and making that modification, because the bottom line is either the bike trailer was or wasn't affixed with a sticker and it says that it was or wasn't meeting the standard. And it's going to be an open and shut case. And I would assume that no individual or an attorney that might be representing a plaintiff bringing a cause for it would do so unless they've got the facts on their side. And so this is one that I would say that the only time you're going to be seeing this type of litigation, if there's going to be one, is where the manufacturers fail to comply with putting a notice saying whether or not it meets the standard that would be considered appropriate for a trailer designed for human passengers. And if the committee so wishes, I will be more than glad to have that modification to the Dash 4s and bring you another one for consideration.
Would that meet your...
Oh, I think so.
Okay. Be more than glad to do that.
Other questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
I only have one other person signed up, Justin Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Justin Freeman, Legislative Assistant to Representative Mitch Greenlich, House District 33. I'm just going to be very brief. I'd like to thank Senator Przanski for introducing this bill. He mentioned our bill regarding bike trailers. That came as a result of a OHSU study on bike commuters that showed that about 20% of all bike commuters, those are people that regularly bike to work, suffered at least one traumatic event during the one-year study period, which led us to ask, you know, there's obviously some safety issues with biking in this state, and how does that affect the most vulnerable bike users, which would be children as passengers. So it's clear that there's still a lot of room for improvement. We introduced our bill, which is HB 2228, which generated a significant amount of interest, to say the least. Ultimately, we decided not to request a hearing on that bill, but we were eager to sign on to Senator Przanski's bill, and we think it's an excellent step towards ensuring the safety of children on bicycles going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. Any questions? No, I see none. Okay, that is all I have signed up. Did anybody else wish to testify on this one? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 846. Senators, we have a number of bills that we have been worked on before that are ready to move. I think we'll move to work session on those first. Let me note for the record that Senate Bill 438, we're going to carry over till Monday. We have yet another amendment that needs to wait for a fiscal. Let's see. And we will not be hearing Senate Bill 930 today either. So with that, I would open the work session on Senate Bill 518. Richard?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 518 provides that notice and public comment provisions of rulemaking do not apply to removal and fill general permits established by rule by the Department of State Lands requires that payment to the Oregon Removal and Fill Mitigation Fund be equal to the actual mitigation project costs if the actual costs are known, and requires the payment amount to the Oregon Removal Fill Mitigation Fund in cases where actual costs are not known be adjusted for variables such as regional differences and mitigation type. This bill was originally heard on 9:30, and there's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, so we now have the fiscal. The chair will move Senate Bill 438 to the floor with a due pass.
This is 430.
We're on 518.
Oh, I'm sorry. Looking in the wrong place. Senate Bill 518 to the floor with the due pass. Sorry about that. Discussion. Senator Girard.
I should have given you a warning, sir. I just don't want to give that rulemaking authority over.
Hmm?
I have problems with the bill. That's a nice way of putting it.
Problems with the bill. So
I will be a no. Just giving you a heads up.
Is there anybody else who has problems with the bill?
No.
Okay. Senate Bill 518 is passed to the floor as a due path. Senator Girard is a no. All right. So now we'll flip it over, and we will open a work. Let's see, I got to close the work session on Senate Bill 518, and we'll open a work session on 725.
Senate Bill 725 authorizes the Director of Employment Department to waive recovery of benefits paid erroneously if the director finds the benefits would be against equity and good conscience. It allows an administrative law judge to reopen a hearing upon a benefits claim if the party shows good cause for failing to appear. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, but there was a fiscal statement issued, but no request to refer it to Ways and Means.
Chair moves Senate Bill 725 to the floor with a due pass. Discussion. Are there any objections? Just kind of looking down the bench here. Senator Girard,
I don't know who that would be.
Are you okay?
Oh, I think so. But
all righty.
I'm so used to getting eaten in my caucus that I get a little nervous. You know? Then I have my colleagues at the other end.
You're not worried about it.
Senate Bill 725 is passed to the floor with a do pass recommendation, a unanimous vote. We'll close the work session on 7:25 and carrier.
It's Rosenbaum and Winters bill. Maybe they would want to carry it.
Let's check with them, see if they'd like to carry it. We'll check with Senator Rosenbaum. If not, I will. And I forgot to assign one on 518. The chair will carry 518. All right, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 877. Richard.
Senate Bill 877 directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to adopt rules implementing the Oregon Coordinate System. It requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to establish an advisory committee before adopting rules required by this measure. There's also a Dash 1 amendment that we have not yet adopted. The Dash 1 has no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact. The original hearing was on March 7th.
Chair moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 877. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I think that you should carry this bill and tell everybody exactly what they're saying.
But, you know, Senator, with all of your interests, I would think that you'd want to carry this
bill. No, I think I'll pass on this.
Discussion on the Dash 1s. Is there any objections to the Dash 1s? Dash 1s are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 877 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with the due pass. Discussion. Seeing none, is there any objections?
You're
good. Okay. Senate Bill 877 is passed to the floor as the due pass. Unanimous vote. We'll close on Senate Bill 877. Let's see. Carrier.
I'm glad you were looking at that, Ann.
All right, Chair's got this one, too. For those who weren't here, it's a bill that has about 50 pages of numbers in it. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 447.
Senate Bill 447 provides that the Department of Transportation may remove personal property deposited, left, or displayed under a state highway bridge along a river within an urban growth boundary after posting written notice within 30 feet of the personal property at least 15 days prior to the removal. Allows the department without written notice to remove personal property in the event of an exceptional emergency, such as possible site contamination by hazardous materials or when there is an immediate danger to human life or safety. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There is also a Dash 3 amendment and a Dash 7 amendment.
The 7 incorporate the 3s?
The 7 is what the sponsor is.
So we don't need the 7 Dash 3.
Yes. And there's no revenue impact and minimal expenditure impact on all of them.
Can you explain what the Dash 7s do?
Sure. The Dash 7 replaces the original measure, basically. The changes are that it deals with the same under the highway, river, within an urban growth boundary, posting of written notice within 30 feet of personal property, but it changes the date to 5 days and no more than 19 days. It also changes the language on the exceptional event and specifies that seasonal increases in river levels are not an exceptional event and will not be exempt from the posting requirements.
And it's Chair's understanding that ODOT and the Law Center are all happy with the bill now. So the Chair will move the Dash 7s to Senate Bill 447. Discussion? Objections? Dash 7s are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 447 as amended by the Dash 7s to the floor with the due pass. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stark.
What's the fiscal on this bill?
Sorry, I didn't. There's no expenditure impact and no. On the Dash 7s, there's minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact. On the original bill, there was no expenditure impact. And I'm not.
I don't know how it's possible. Is anybody here from ODOT? I don't know, Mr. Chair, I don't know how it's possible for there not to be some sort of impact if ODOT is going to store some people's stuff. It's got to be
I think they already do it.
They already do it. This just, I think, would you have the concern. Please come up.
Chair Byer, Senator Starr, Shibblehead with the Oregon Law Center. I can explain there are current rules in place that already require ODOT to store personal property that's not junk.
Okay.
And so there's just a codification of that part in the statute. There's no change to their current practice.
Well, if you'll recall, Senator, this was more of a noticing requirement.
Yeah, very good.
Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion? Hearing none, is there any objection? Did I move it?
You did move.
I did move it. Okay. Senate Bill 447, as amended by the dash sevens, is adopted. Passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Carrier. Floydsville? Was this Floydsville?
Yeah. It was.
We will ask Senator Przanski if he likes to would like to carry this. Let's see. Now we're down to... We will open a work session on Senate Bill 217. Richard.
Senate Bill 217 permits urban renewal plans to include school construction or reconstruction projects, permits the urban renewal plan in effect for at least 10 years to add a limited amount of non-contiguous land to urban renewal areas, and exempts It exempts tax increment revenues used for school projects within urban renewal plans from being subject to the limitations of other funds. Takes effect 91 days following adjournment, sine die. There is a dash one amendment which specifies that non-contiguous land can only be added to an urban renewal area of a large metropolitan plan. There's minimal fiscal impact, and I just received the revenue impact. And it is what revenue calls a revenue light because there's a subsequent referral to the revenue committee. That was handed out to you guys.
Okay, the chair moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 217. Discussion. Seeing none, is there any objection?
I got a question. Can I have a
discussion?
Question,
Senator Girard.
I just want to make sure. I mean, we're moving a lot of bills. Is this the Park Rose School?
Yes, it is. For the discussion?
Yes. I thought this was to be restricted to Portland only.
It is.
Is it? Okay.
I believe the reference to large metropolitan plan restricts it to Portland area.
Okay. Perfect.
Yes, this is a special interest bill.
It is.
Is there a further discussion? Is there any objections to the dash ones? Dash ones are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 217 as amended by the dash ones to Finance and Revenue Committee.
With
the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Are there any objections? Senate Bill 217 as amended by the dash ones is moved to Finance and Revenue Committee with the due pass recommendation. Okay, now we're down to the open work session on Senate Bill 37. Richard?
I do not even have a staff member summary on this.
This is a request. We requested by leadership to move the bill to Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Starr?
I'll object.
Excuse me?
I'll object to that.
Okay.
I believe that this is an important policy issue. This is related to House Bill 2001, which we passed, the legislature passed the last session. I believe that this is a policy that this committee ought to weigh in on. It is not something that is solely a Ways and Means issue. Though this bill, all it does is change a number, the overall policy is something that this committee ought to engage with. And I believe we will in Senate Bill 128, which I hope to have on the calendar in the next 2 weeks. This has to do with how we're going to spend the money that are listed in the Section 64 of House Bill 2001 that lists all the projects. And for us to just arbitrarily say we're going to support increasing the dollar line item on one particular project in that bill, I think is counter to us having a broader discussion about that.
Other feelings?
Mr. Chair, I will join Senator Starr in that.
Hmm?
I will join Senator Starr in that.
I'll join my colleagues.
We will close the public work session on Senate Bill 37. All right, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 507.
Richard. Senate Bill 507 imposes building code requirements that new construction or rehabilitation of multifamily housing include a television antenna system. We already began the public hearing on Monday for this bill, so this is just a continuation. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact, but there is a tax credit component in this bill, so LRO requests a subsequent referral to the tax credit committee.
And did we get a proposed amendment to this?
Good task force.
Well, let's just let Mr. Lutag
just amend to 5-4. I think those amendments are being passed out right now.
Okay. Go ahead. Whenever you're ready.
I'm doing my show on
television. You're working on it, huh?
There was a question asked earlier. Senator Byers, members of the committee. First of all, my name is Ken Lutag, and I'm going to be wearing two hats here. First hat is I am a co-owner in Northwest Television, which has some television stations here, and that will be relevant to what I'm going to be getting into. My second hat, which is really what instigated this bill, is I'm also the chair of the Emergency Alert System for Marion, Polk, and Yamhill Counties. I work very closely with the emergency people here, and that's what kind of really spurred this. First, let me frame this a little bit. As the economy has been taking a toll, more and more people are looking at what they can do to realign their spending habits. One of the things that we're looking at is entertainment. We as broadcasters have completed the transition from analog to digital communications, better known as DTV. With the advent of DTV, most people can get more channels of digital quality. As an example, depending on your location, people here in Salem can receive almost 30 channels. Third quarter of last year, 600,000 people dropped cable. Nationally, 500,000 the quarter prior to that. Some of those did go to satellite, but a number of those have not done that. What happens is that these people are, what they're looking at is they're watching their day-to-day television on a TV set. And then what they're doing is downloading things like Netflix, any kind of other programming that they want to do seems to be the trend that we're finding. A local antenna installer we have is installing three, that's just here in Salem, is installing three antennas every day. All these are in single-family dwellings, duplexes, and those kind of buildings. The problem is that you, in the area, you seem to need an outside antenna. And now there's an opportunity for other people. The problem we have is people that are living in apartment complexes do not have the option of putting an antenna in, mainly because of restrictions the landlord's going to place on them, but also the problem they can't use in rabbit ears or something like that if you're in the Salem area, for example, or if you're in a building orientation does not allow that to happen. What we're asking for in here is to give a choice for people to install, install an antenna, coax, splitters, and this is becoming television stations try to work with these people on a day-to-day basis. Sometimes there's really no good answer. Why is it important other than attempting to give apartment residents a way to see television? This is with my hat of the chairman of the emergency operational area. If a person decides to drop cable and go just with internet, then all their news and information have a problem during an emergency. Take, for instance, the recent tornado we had here. We only had minutes to get important information to residents. Currently, and in the foreseeable future, our only hope is TV, radio, cable, and to get immediate information to many people as we can. We've understood in the emergency communications that we're not going to get to everybody, but we want to try and get to as many people as we possibly can in the shortest amount of time. Not only this, but not only the immediate information, but the long-term information becomes important as well. We know that cellular phones, landlines, and the like will be down. If we had an example, which is my worst-case example here, is if Detroit dam breaks, we know we're going to lose cable, we know landline phones are going to be gone, and we know that the cellular systems is going to be completely devastated. So the only way we can get to the group of people is to give them information. The best information is going to come by radio and television at that point. Television is going to provide video and audio communications as well as radio stations are going to do that. The other thing is we're going to be on the air. Almost every television station in the area has a generator, and we will be on the air. The question was asked whether or not there's any portable TVs. This is a portable television that I purchased for $49. It's battery operated. all it needs is an antenna. That's what this bill is about, is giving the ability for an apartment dweller to have the option of getting an antenna. We're not saying take away cable. We're not saying anything else. We're saying give them the option of doing that. A full disclosure, there are some concerns in this bill, and they were voiced earlier. One of them is that we're merging landlord-tenant law and building codes. What we have some proposed amendments that you should have in front of you. Basically, we've completely severed the entire landlord-tenant section of this and put it all in building codes. We've also, by the request of a couple of the other parties involved, we've removed actually the requirement for an antenna on it, but mainly the wiring to be installed so that the landlord has the option of putting an antenna in the system. We're talking about new construction here, and we also, by the way, removed renovations. There was no good definition, and we didn't have time to find a good definition for renovation, so we removed that. All we're asking is for antenna cabling to be installed in a building during construction. It's a minimal cost item, but if you try and do that at a later time, it's not going to happen. And that's really basically what we're asking for in this bill.
Questions? Senator
Atkinson. Thank you. Can a cable be split to handle two channels?
As in, sorry.
Two TVs?
No, Senator Byers.
No, can a coax, most new construction will have a digital coax on it. That's the first question. And then the second question is, can that be split for both kinds of television?
Senator Atkins, Senator Byers. The answer is no. What we've asked for this to do the answer is no, we can't do that, sorry. The answer is what we've asked for is a separate drop to be put in each location. There is another way of doing that. We could split it, and that's up to whoever does it, does the installation. The original concept was one antenna, one cable coming down to where the splitter is for cable TV and be able to choose between the two. What we've asked for is to give them an option of just running a single coax to each resident.
One follow-up question. I'm on a board that has a low-power UHF station, and that station broadcasts on rabbit ears. It also broadcasts as a must-carry on cable, and it just about a couple months ago developed an app that it's on iPod and phone. Just devil's advocate, wouldn't that take care of the problem in an emergency?
Senator Byers, Senator Atkins, no. Here's what we go to the worst-case scenario where your cell phone's not going to work at all in the worst-case scenario. I can use an example. Whenever we had the floods, I think it was, over in Tillamook, there was absolutely no data communications out of there. The only communications available to the area was ham radio operation.
Thank you. Senator
Durant. Thank you, Chair. I just say now the Detroit Dam breaks, you'll need a new senator, too, to live below the dam. and that goes to ham. It seems to me like the best preparation, I think, that for Nonia and whatever, is ham radios. Mm-hmm. And I just was wondering if you had an opinion on that. Do you have an opinion on ham radios?
Senator Byers, Senator Durant, I am a ham operator. And I think ham operation is a very good way to get communications in from long distances. This bill is really trying to address getting to the general populace is really what I do. But ham operators, there's some new technology coming out. Matter of fact, they were using it in Japan. I just saw it. Basically, every phone went off in Japan to indicate there was a tsunami coming. That stuff's coming. But we have, again, working with the emergency communications people, we have to plan on the worst-case scenarios.
More? Thank you very much. Andrea Fug. Oh, just got Nellie DeVries. DeVries? Oh, I said that wrong. And Cindy Roberts.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Andrea Fogg with Building Codes Division. We haven't had the opportunity to review the amendment, but as to the original bill, as drafted, it's very problematic for the Building Codes Division. That is because it commingles the landlord-tenant and building codes division statutes. And what that does is puts some problematic terminology definitions into the building codes that would potentially supersede what we have in the codes as they exist today. The reason that we have that type of language in the code is because the codes are adopted and reviewed on a regular basis, meaning that we don't have to come back to the legislature every time we need to change terminology in those definitions. And so, as drafted, we have concerns with this legislation.
So, would you have the same concerns if the dash threes, dash ones, put them solely in the building codes?
Mr. Chair, again, I haven't had the opportunity to look at those amendments, so we would be happy to take a look, review those, and let you know. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nellie DeVries, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association. I'm basically here to reiterate what Andrea previously said, but as the bill stands now, we do have serious concerns regarding actually changing the building codes and having this actually implemented through the building codes. You know, as I'd like to say, the sole purpose of the state building code is to establish uniform performance standards, providing reasonable safeguards for health, safety, welfare, comfort, and security of the residents of the state, and therefore we believe that they should remain solely for that purpose and not incorporate landlord-tenant law in them as well. So if you have any questions, I'll leave it open to that.
I guess I would ask you the same question, probably unfairly, and ask Andrea.
And Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to repeat her
answer. Same answer, huh? Yep. Okay.
Cindy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I represent the Rental Housing Association of Greater Portland. Our initial concern with this, of course, caused a huge argument in my household. Having a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old, they absolutely believe that having a television is part of habitability. But I do not believe it is, and I do not believe it belongs in landlord-tenant law as one of those things that we must provide, like water, sewer, plumbing, electricity. So that was the first concern. I did recently see some amendments that are being considered that make it just part of the building codes. But it actually, I'd like to take it back a little bit to the premise here. The premise here is that there's many people who can get the television stations and want them. And actually, according to the FCC, 5 channels are available to 90% of the population using an antenna for their television. And also, according to the FCC, about 10 to 14% of U.S. households actually rely on that use. So that's of concern to us, that where's the need here? Secondly, as I came up, I was really still looking at my computer. I was trying to get the statistics for you, and I'll still try and get those to you afterwards, on how people usually get federal communication alert information. Is it mostly through the TV? Is it mostly through the radio? You've heard that that's a big reason for this bill, although I would argue that we at no time have made people have TVs and have radios in their car and listen to those so they can get those alerts. So I'm not sure that's the best argument, but I will try to get you some statistics on the ways that's usually utilized.
Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair Barr. I think one thing that was brought up that is very interesting is, and that is, in a catastrophe, ham radios are what work. This deals with TVs. I do believe that the industry is going to have to look at ways that we can get the word out, especially in tsunami zones and that sort of thing. So, whereas this needs work, I think we need to go in that direction, just so put that on the record.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Drott, I think you bring up a good point. What's the best way to make sure people have emergency information, especially for people like me who don't watch TV? I will tell you, I was in Lincoln City during the tsunami alert, and we did have sirens go off, and that was the prevalent way for us all to know what it meant.
Other questions?
Yes.
Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Vries, I have a few questions for you. In addition to lobbying, what else do you do?
Well, I attend law school.
And
would like to know.
Yes, you attend. Are you taking a business course too? And if so, what's the name of that course?
Why, yes, I am. It's Business of Government.
Is that right? Mr. Reese, could you please define for me the word sandbagger?
Senator,
you'll see. A sandbagger is someone who goes to a poker game and says, "Is it like Go Fish?" Someone who says, "I'm just a country boy," right before a big line of questions. Tell me, what is your definition of sandbagger?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I'll let you all define that one for yourself.
Mr. Chair, I was a guest in her business graduate school class a couple days ago in which she had to demonstrate testifying before a committee. And I was very nice to her as she clearly outshined her classmates by miles. And I think you're sandbagging in the class, and I won't tell anybody.
Is there anything relevant to this bill?
None at all. Nothing at all.
Thank you, Paul. That is all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 507? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 507. And let's see. We'll move to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 898.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 898 allows the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, Oregon Health Authority, or local public health authority to request proof that a person performing work at a restaurant meets applicable age minimum requirements. It allows the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, Oregon Health Authority, or local public health authority to order a person to immediately cease activity that is subject to the minimum age requirement if requested proof of age is not supplied. There is a -1 amendment, which basically takes out the Oregon Health Authority or local public health authority from having the authority to request that proof, and there's no revenue impact, and I believe, let me make sure I'm right, there's minimal fiscal impact for the -1 amendments, but I have not yet received a fiscal on the original bill.
No. Senator, sir, are you sure you want to do this with Atkinson up here?
I'm not sure, actually, but since you called the bill, I think I'd better explain it to you. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm the senator representing Western Washington County, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 898 and the -1 amendments that we propose to be adopted and the bill be moved forward. Quite simply, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is part of a number of bills that have been introduced this legislative session to deal with the issue of human sex trafficking. And most of those bills have been worked or are being worked in our judiciary committees. This one just happened to be referred to this committee, and I'd ask that you look favorably on it. Honestly, it's a simple bill. It would require the OLCC or would allow the OLCC when they're in establishments to basically ascertain the age of the folks that are working there. What we're talking about, strictly speaking, really is adult establishments where you have dancers. And what we know as it relates to the sex trafficking industry is that adult entertainers tend to also be young ladies or women who are potential victims of sex trafficking. And not in all cases, but in some cases that's the case. And what we want to do is identify underage girls and intervene in a way that, one, gets them off the stage, but also provides an opportunity to provide a way out. It's a very simple bill, to be honest with you. It doesn't cost anything because you've got OLCC staff and individuals that are in these establishments already. And if we can identify an underage girl that's in these establishments working, it's highly likely that they're not there on their own volition, and it provides an opportunity to intervene. And so for those reasons, I'd ask that you adopt the -1 amendment and we move this bill forward and it join with, quite honestly, a number of other bills that are dealing with human sex trafficking in this particular legislative session. So with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity, appreciate the hearing. And I'd be open to answer a question or two if you had some. The -1 amendments basically take out the health authority. The Oregon Restaurant Association was concerned about opening up virtually every restaurant in Oregon to the Oregon Health Authority coming in and talking about ages and whatnot. And that's not the target, wasn't the target. Every one of these adult establishments, save one that I know of, is an OLCC-regulated venue. And so we catch 99.9% of the venues we want to catch by utilizing OLCC as the state agency. And again, these OLCC employees are already in these establishments, so that's not an additional burden to the agency. And I believe you'll hear from OLCC in support of the Dash 1 amendments to the bill.
Senator, I assume that this one is directed at, and let me use the term very loosely, entertainment?
Yeah, adult. I mean, yeah, you're talking about adult entertainment, and you're talking about female entertainers, and you know, we've had lots of conversations in this building about adult establishments and regulated them, and you know, that's not what this is about. But this is about the young ladies that are participating in the entertainment in these establishments. If we can ascertain that there's an underage girl that's dancing, it's highly likely that young lady is not there on her own volition, and it will provide an opportunity, one, for us to identify who that young girl is and potentially rescue, I use that term, rescue that young lady from being trafficked. This is a continuum in the trafficking world.
Questions? Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. I'd love to have Senator Starr with a few definitions, but I'm going to leave it. So we're not going to do that. But there seems to be a loophole in the bill, Bruce, and that is that not all of the dance clubs fall under OLCC purview. And I was just wondering if you had any suggestions on how to tighten that up.
Well, that's the challenge that we faced. If you move the bill as it was originally drafted, you would catch everybody, but you'd also catch every McDonald's and, you know, every restaurant in the state, and that's not the target. As I mentioned in my testimony, 90, and I think there's one or two in the state that of these adult establishments that are what they're called juice bars, where they don't serve alcohol. But, you know, 99.9% of the time, they are establishments that are regulated by the OLCC. So I'm much happier. I'm happy with getting 99% of the way there, and as opposed to not doing this at all.
I'm good. Good, Bill.
Thank you.
Let's see here. What did they do with that paper? Mr. Irwin? There you go. Oh, here it is.
I can just deal with this one. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Irwin, the Government Affairs and Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And here in support of Senate Bill 898, the commissioners have voted unanimously to support this bill for the records that Senator Starr already outlined. I just wanted to briefly remind the legislators that back in 2010, House Bill 3623 was passed, and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission actually started to get involved in the human trafficking issue by enclosing a letter at renewal time. Renewals occur quarterly, so by region, and so we did this four times during the year, in which a letter was sent out to all our licensees, along with a sticker that the licensees could place in their window with a toll-free hotline number for people that may be victims or aware of an issue in their establishment or somewhere that they could contact people to get help and assistance if they were feeling that someone was being taken advantage of or they were themselves were being taken advantage of. So we've been involved in this issue to some extent in the last year, and we are more than happy, since we're already in the licensed establishments, as Senator Starr has outlined, to do this. We do to some extent already, but this certainly helps us have clear statutory authority and gives us additional backing for doing so. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
So, Tom, it seems like I recall that the commission was moving down this road a number of years ago, and stopped at the request of Governor Kulongowski, and the issue then was, and it's part of the First Amendment of defining what's entertainment, and as I recall, the issue that came up then was you had to exclude anyone who was under 21, which would get at Senator Starr's objection, frankly, without going into it. But the other problem was that the entertainment union, the musicians union, I think it was, objected because lots of the bars and that was where a lot of the bands get started, and this would preclude them as well. So it would take musicians who are under 21 out of the places where they usually practice. Is that still the case, or have you found a way around that?
Chair Byron and members of the committee, I probably wasn't in this position I'm in today when that occurred, so I'm probably not the right person to ask that question. I'm going to turn my head here and ask if the Enforcement Director, Linda Gnowski, who's in the audience sitting with me, she could probably fill us in.
Pass the buck.
Yeah, that's right. I'm definitely passing the buck. I remember we had some advisory committee hearings about this and some rulemaking on it, so I'm pretty certain that we did address the musician union issue, but Linda could probably fill us in on the specifics because I don't recall.
So how do you resolve that problem? And
for
the record, you are?
Chairman Barnes, I'm Linda Ignowski. I'm the Regulatory Services Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I do remember this, and we have fixed this in our rules. And so minor entertainers are allowed in establishments that are normally excluded for anybody under the age of 21. They have to, if they're a juvenile, they have to notify us, but they can do it. We have stipulations of how they can have the entertainers in there. They can't stay in the place after they've finished their entertainment. They have to leave the place. If there's a break, they have to have a break room for them to go to separate from the alcohol area. So we have defined this by rule so the musicians now can be in entertainment places. The only even in minor entertainers in adult establishments, they have to be at least 18 before they can do that. But it's it's worked, and we did try to solve it, because the main one is the bands. We had a huge uproar with that.
I support where we're trying to go with this, but I'm lost in how you get the definition between a female dancer, if you will, who perhaps when she finishes her performance on the stage goes to the break room, and a young guitarist.
The dancer doesn't have a guitar?
Yeah, try that one in court.
Senator Byers, I think what the human trafficking is really looking at, minors that are under the age of 18. You're looking at 14, 15, 16-year-old kids.
So I guess that you're concerned.
Yeah.
That's exactly
it's
that's
not...
The 18 works?
It's 14-year-olds to 17-year-olds. People under 18.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Durant?
I'd just like to ask a simple question. If by statute, is there any reason that we couldn't restrict someone into going into a bar unless they were 21? And that's where the definition of entertainment comes in, and that's why I've always been kind of under the assumption that we couldn't do that, but I was just kind of curious if we could.
Chairman Beyer, Senator Gerard, we do have minor postings that you see a lot of places that don't allow anybody under the age of 21 to enter, which is your bars, your taverns, your lounges are number two. We can do that by our minor posting. We've made exceptions based on the minor entertainers, people who are service people, somebody who needs to go, a plumber or electrician who's under the age of 21, they can go in and do that. And I think this bill continues to allow those people to go in and fix something even if they're not. So we do have the ability to bar people from under the age of 21. We have made exceptions for entertainers.
I personally would just as soon do away with the 18-year from 18 to 21 to have that for entertainers, because I think that's where they're. So I would go even further than this bill does.
We've had that discussion already.
Hmm?
We've had that discussion already.
with, as it relates to the entertainer, the musicians.
Yeah, I know that's a long-standing thing. I just...
I'm willing to go farther.
I'm willing to go further. And the thing is, the trafficking of young women has become such a problem that the benefits by allowing people to play in the band between 18 and 21 versus the young women being being used, I would think would be probably a good word. Or I just think we need to do whatever we can to sever that relationship. So I just think they should be older.
Any other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on this? It's a brave crowd today. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 898 and open a work session on Senate Bill 898. Senator Starr?
Move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 898.
Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 898. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? The -1s to Senate Bill 898 are adopted. Senator Starr?
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended by the -1s to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved the -1s. Excuse me, Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 898 as amended by the -1 to the floor with the due pass. Discussion?
No, he's here for the vote.
Okay. Senator Edwards, for information, we are moving, we have a motion on the floor to move Senate Bill 898 with, as amended by the -1 to the floor with the due pass. Further discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, Senate Bill 898, as amended by the -1, is moved to the floor. It was the due pass. Senator Starr will carry. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 898, and let's see. We're down to...
554.
Yep. We're down to Senate Bill 5. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 554.
Richard. Senate Bill 554 creates a task force on renewable resource generation and transmission development areas. If sunsets the task force on a date of the 2013 legislative session and it declares an emergency effective on passage. We also have a -2 amendment which removes state and federal agencies directors as well as the director of the League of Oregon City and League and the Association of Oregon Counties from the task force and encourages them to share expertise with the task force. It also adds a member representing a conservation organization in Oregon to the members that the governor shall appoint, and it removes the ability of task force members to receive reimbursement for expenses. There's no revenue impact on the -1s. I have not yet received a fiscal impact on the -2s. There's no revenue impact on the original bill, but there is a fiscal impact on the original bill.
Okay, so we will not be able to move today, but we can hear it. Senator Edwards, would you like to introduce it?
Yeah, I'll just introduce the how I came to bring this bill forward. During the interim, it was brought to my attention that ODF&W has created a sage-grouse plan with the essential intent of identifying critical sage-grouse habitat in eastern Oregon, because sage-grouse is a it is warranted but precluded from being listed. And, of course, we don't want to end up in a situation where we have another spotted owl. But at the same time, when we look at that critical sage-grouse habitat, it overlays, or it's in a lot of the same areas that we need for renewable wind, renewable energy development, wind transmission, et cetera. So, you know what, even though I knew Senator Atkinson loathes task force bills, I thought this sounds like the topic for a task force. So in working with the renewable energy community, have brought forth this concept. My staff, Sarah Hoyt, has worked on the bill more than anybody, so I asked her to come and walk us through it.
Sarah?
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Hoyt, and I am the legislative policy aide to Senator Chris Edwards. Like Senator Edwards says, our office has been working on developing this concept over the interim. It's very similar to a bill that was introduced by the Colorado legislature in 2009 that develops a task force to look at renewable energy generation potential. The Dash 2s that have been presented by our office basically gut and stuff the bill. And it is a shame that we don't have the fiscal back because there would be no fiscal. There's two main purposes to the bill. One would be to identify renewable resource generation potentials around the state, and then two, to develop an accurate map of existing resources and potential future resources that could exist. The process that would take place under this task force would be a public process. There'd be public meetings. They'd have to hold at least four over the course of the life of the task force and receive input from both the public and various agencies and organizations. The Dash 2s also request that the task force operate under existing resources, so no money can be allocated from the state to it. However, the task force can accept gifts from private agencies if necessary and directs the legislative administrator to then go ahead and take those gifts, put them in the general fund, and then have that money sent back to the task force. People that participate in the task force from state agencies are not available for compensation or reimbursement, and it does actually ask that a report be made to the legislature by October of 2012, and the task force sunsets before the legislature convenes the 2013 session. So if there's any direct questions, I can try and answer them as best I can.
Questions, Sarah?
That'll be nice.
I'm trying to be
there. Edwards, do you have questions of your staff?
I've been thinking about it, but I don't know.
You're supposed to do that upstairs. Thank you, Sarah.
No, great, thanks.
Chair?
She knows too much.
You have a question. Oops.
I don't have a question for her, but I do have a question for Senator Edwards.
There's a reason I'm sitting up here, not now. Oh, go ahead.
And I share Senator Atkinson's disdain for task forces. Now, I do agree with where this is going and why we need it, but the governor is kind of a political individual, and for the governor to have I'm going to go there a little bit. He tends to be a little on the political side. To make all the appointments, and the problem with task forces, as far as I'm concerned, is the people on the task force is going to determine what the decision is. So is there any way that we can kind of balance this out a little bit so that maybe people like myself are better represented?
Mr. Chair, if I want.
You sure can.
I might want a little bit of clarification for what people like myself means, but but beyond
sort of
that,
like entertainment, we probably don't want to go there.
But
oh, I'm thinking he wants to go there.
But beyond that, I can't think now. But beyond that, I share concerns about the makeup of task force. I've opposed bills based on the makeup of those of task forces before. I'm certainly open to input about who should be on the task force that isn't. Somebody has to make the appointments, and I didn't specify that Senator Girard would be making the appointments, but
I've oftentimes seen where like the Speaker of the House makes some appointments.
Can I draw your attention to page two of the
we have some of that
Dash twos. You've got the President of the Senate, and
line
the
one and
of
line
the House,
four,
I guess.
Appointing a member.
Well, I'm just looking at party affiliation. I'll be real honest. Yeah. And the President of the Senate's a Democrat. The Governor's a Democrat. Speaker of the House is split. So I don't see a balanced committee coming out of this.
So what was your point?
Well, my point is. Oh, God, this is killing me. I just think that if you're going to have a task force and you want it to be functional, that it needs to be balanced. And so I like the dash twos, but I think you need to change the weighting of it. And so maybe the Republican Party in the Senate gets a one seat, the Democrats get one seat, and that sort of thing. So it's sort of somewhat balanced. I mean, I don't know. I've been through too many task forces that, in all honesty, by the minute this formed, you know where it's going. And if you want an honest opinion, I think it just has to be balanced. I support the concept.
I understand your point, Senator, and I think we'll hear the rest of the witnesses, and then Senator Edwards might have to consider the vote count.
All right.
It's relating. It's narrow. I think it's pretty narrow.
As I read the amendment, the task force has two goals or two objectives. Identify, and that's in page 2, lines 10 through 19. Is that right? Is that the goal?
I think we should probably call my staff back up.
I want to make sure, what's the end product that we're hoping to deliver from the task force?
Yeah, the map and identifying development areas.
But you don't talk about the sage grouse in here.
It's bigger than just that issue, but I mean that issue was the catalyst that started the discussion.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. That's enough of that. We'll move on to, let's see, Judge Thompson, Ann Hannes, and Liz Nyson.
Chair Beyer, for the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'd like to introduce Judge Gary Thompson to my right. He's with Sherman County. He's had extensive experience working with renewable energy development on behalf of the county. He also chairs AOC's Energy and Environment Committee. So I'm going to turn it over for him to talk about this. You also have a copy of our written testimony. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Gary Thompson. I'm Sherman County Judge, and explain all the committees that I sit on. AOC supports Senate Bill 544 with the Amendment 2. I have to agree a little bit with Senator Girard. It's going to be key to who gets put on this committee. I'm going off script, so excuse me a little bit, but Senator brought up a good point. It's coming clear that the state of Oregon needs to do a better job preparing communities for the possibility of renewable energy throughout the state. The counties have increasingly required additional permits, additional conditions on these and the state on these developers. Off script, what we found is these changes have caused the developers quite a bit of concern, both financially and a lot of other reasons, but it's primarily financially. Every time we get a committee together, they think, here comes some more problems down the line. But at the same time, we need to get a handle on fish and game, BLM, which we really don't have any control over, and some of the land planning issues. We need to come up with a map of all the areas that can be areas where renewable energy can be put together. There are not that many in the wind industry. There's quite a few in the solar industry. The wave, there's only one place it could be, is along the coast. The geothermal can only be handled where there is geothermal. So we need a good map, or we actually would have that's available, but the legislators need a good map to see exactly where all the locations are for. In addition to that, the Senate Bill 554 has great potential to reconvene an orderly planning process for formatting the sound renewable energy development in Oregon. But I think it needs to go a little deeper than that. I'm going to leave you guys thinking about that, and I'll pass the buck.
One thing that I do want to add to Judge Thompson's testimony is that in looking at this task force, it's also kind of good to look at the bigger picture in terms of having this be considered as part of kind of a within an umbrella of a governance system for energy for the state, particularly at the Department of Energy, and the need for a commission or some way to coordinate the different task forces that have been on energy. This, we think, is very important because of its need to look at siting issues and how you put together a map and where we can make the most use of renewable energy. So we really commend Senator Edwards for bringing this forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, and the rest of the committee. I'm Liz Nyson, for the record, from the Oregon Natural Desert Association. I'm the Energy Policy Coordinator. ONDA is a nonprofit conservation organization headquartered in Bend with offices in Portland and Ontario. We strive to protect, defend, and restore Oregon's high desert and represent over 1,500 members throughout Oregon. We support renewable energy development and believe renewable energy development is compatible with our mission to ensure long-term protection for our high desert resources. One of the ways we feel we can do this is by promoting responsible energy generation and policies that guarantee projects are sited, permitted, and developed in a way that is compatible with our natural environment. We support the passage of Senate Bill 554 with amendments. We support the amendment to add the conservation interest, and we would like this to go a little bit farther, and I'll discuss those changes with you in just a moment. Senate Bill 554 will create a task force on renewable energy development that will identify areas suitable for renewable energy generation through a collaborative stakeholder-based process. We support the concept of a task force to help navigate the complex issues surrounding renewable energy planning and siting in Oregon. However, without proposed amendments, conservation and wildlife interests will not be represented on the task force. These issues of wildlife and conservation and renewable energy siting is a critical one to address upfront in incorporating relevant data and expertise. In doing so, products created by the task force will reduce future siting conflicts and provide a clear vision for the state and energy industry. The task force proposed in the Senate bill includes 7 representatives of the energy industry, and that includes developers and utilities, 1 from agriculture, 1 from the tribes, 1 from cities, 1 from counties, 2 from state agencies, but this does not include ODF&W, 1 from the federal agency representative, and 5 appointed through the Senate and House. More than a third of these 19 stakeholders are representing an economic interest, but none of the members on this group are representing wildlife and their habitats. And as it was stated earlier, the sage-grouse issue is an important one, and it's something that has generated a lot of conflict and concern throughout the state with renewable energy siting. Conservation groups continue to play an active role in supporting renewable energy and helping to minimize the impacts on those special species and places we all enjoy in Oregon. Below are the proposed amendments that I have in the testimony. And this, these amendments are supported by groups including Hells Canyon Preservation Council, which is based in LeGrand, and Audubon Society of Portland. In these amendments, we respectfully ask the committee to expand the list of stakeholders to balance the membership on the task force. And in addition, we ask the committee to require the task force to consider wildlife and natural resource issues and planning. These actions will help prevent conflicts early on in the process to promote responsible energy development. I appreciate your time, and I have the proposed amendments on the bottom of my testimony, and this includes adding the director of ODF&W, having two representatives from the conservation community, and then within sections regarding identifying renewable energies and mapping, having it be specific in areas identified as having low environmental conflicts. Thank you.
Questions on this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's see here. Steve Kafori, Lauren Prenude, and Seth Pickett.
It's well balanced.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, and we're strongly in support of this bill. We're planners, and we think when somebody suggests that it's good for the state to do planning, that makes sense to us. I have not seen the amendments, so I can't comment on what those amendments are. I do think that a couple of comments that our folks would like to have from the original bill is that we think it's important to have a member of ODF&W on the panel. I was just watching this week in Ways and Means when the issue was raised about what the role of ODF&W is in specifically in this area of citing renewables. And the answer, which is I think everyone should be happy with, is it's been an enormously successful cooperative relationship. Industry has been working well with the agency. Agency has been working well with the industry. I think they're the ones that have the technical expertise, and I think also I agree with Senator Girard that it's important who's on these commissions for the appearance sake. And just saying we're going to go and talk to them afterwards is not nearly as important as appearance as having someone actually on the commission. I also think we need to have someone representing the environmentalists on here. I think what we do not want to have in a good planning process is to have something that's produced which then is criticized later. The whole purpose of planning is to give predictability. And so I think we want to have this body made up of people who are going to have their discussions internally and not have the discussions and disagreements after the plan is developed. I would just say one other thing, and I think you might want to take a look at from a planning point of view, is that if you're going to locate sites where renewable energies and transmission lines are good and appropriate, I think you might ought to also have them look at sites that are not good and not appropriate. Again, the more that you can do ahead of this from a planning point of view, the more that you give predictability to those people who want to be engaged in this, which we are very supportive of.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Edwards. Clarification, because this has come up twice now. On page 4 of the bill, section 15, line 20, it says all agencies of state government as defined in ORS 174.111 are directed to assist the task force in the performance, blah, 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 blah. That 174.111, I asked before the hearing, does that include ODF&W? And it does. It does not call out the director of ODF&W specifically, but as far as ODF&W representation on the task force and assistance with the work, I believe that it's the intent that that's covered there.
Can I ask a question? Thank you, Chair Meyer, and probably this goes to Senator Edwards again. What's your definition of renewable?
Senator Drug, my definition, or
defined in statute somewhere?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Because cogeneration to me is renewable, and that was one that hasn't been mentioned. So,
Senator, I suspect what he's focusing on here is the solar, wind, and geothermal.
Well, I would beg to differ and probably say hydro and cogeneration would also be renewable.
Hydro would be a point. Yeah, point there.
See, that's where if you get the right, being able to have a little voice, we might change a few things going into this.
All righty. Who's next?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Seth Prickett, and I'm pleased to speak to you today on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers in support of Senate Bill 554. Oregon is well situated for greater economic growth through the development of renewable energy facilities and transmission projects. IBEW has a well-trained workforce, many of whom are currently out of work and ready to build these projects. Unfortunately, to get a wind farm, geothermal plant, transmission line, or solar array off the ground, it can take years due to the siting process. This means our jobs are being put on hold. Currently, each project looking to develop in the state has to go through its own process and negotiations before moving forward. Senate Bill 554 would move us in the direction of streamlining the process and give these projects a clearer understanding of where they can and cannot build. We are sensitive to the environmental and regional concerns and believe that Senate Bill 554 would allow the state to address all these issues at once. No matter your preference on how energy is produced, Senate Bill 554 would create an accountable and transparent process for statewide energy development and, most importantly, get Oregonians back to work. We urge your support on this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Lauren?
Good afternoon, Chair Byers, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Prince. I'm a renewable energy policy associate with the Renewable Northwest Project. For over 17 years, RNP has been advocating for responsibly sited renewable energy projects in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. Our 59 members represent solar, wind, and geothermal energy developers, as well as affiliated businesses such as engineering and construction firms, renewable energy manufacturers, environmental groups, ratepayer advocates. The list goes on. Today I rise in support of Senate Bill 554 and applaud the state of Oregon's efforts to streamline future renewable energy development. Throughout the recent economic downturn, renewable energy development has been a bright spot in an otherwise dark period. We estimate that renewable energy industry has brought to the state over nearly $6 billion in investments. And these investments are primarily concentrated in areas of rural Oregon, which have suffered disproportionate job losses as a result of recent economic occurrences. These billions of dollars represent new long-term family-wage jobs that allow rural Oregonians to remain in their communities and to raise their children with an improved economic future. And while a dozen jobs earning $60,000 annually may not seem like very much to folks living in metropolitan Oregon, I can assure you that those dozen jobs in Morrow County are equivalent to the creation of two new solar roll facilities in Washington or Multnomah counties, or the equivalent of approximately 4,000 new urban jobs. It is important to recognize that constructing renewable energy, from planning and construction phases through long-term operation, provides significant increased value to rural communities in eastern Oregon and where economic engines come along rarely. Beyond the jobs associated with the billions of dollars invested by the renewable energy industry, there are other economic benefits that spread throughout the state. These include increasing county tax bases, funding for schools, and infrastructure improvements such as road repair and partnering with emergency response departments to improve local maps and accelerate rural response capacities. Given the strong and sustained economic benefits of renewable energy, the question remains, how does Oregon plan for its energy needs? As the accompanying maps show, Oregon is blessed with an abundance of renewable energy resource potential, and many of these resources are concentrated in areas of the state where population densities are low and economic development is most needed. As we pursue policies that reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, build jobs and economic opportunity in natural resource-dependent communities, our challenge is to harness these resources responsibly and for the greatest benefit of all Oregonians. We are in support of Senate Bill 554 as amended because the Task Force on Renewable Resource Generation and Transmission will provide the much-needed direction that renewable energy proponents require in order to operate business successfully and to continue creating new job opportunities throughout the state. The task force gathers all the primary experts that work within the energy industry in order to identify and create territorial areas in Oregon that feature a confluence of plentiful renewable resources, suitable topography for infrastructure development, and adequate transmission capabilities. These priority areas will be represented in a final mapping exercise that will promote a competitive business climate in proximity to clusters of renewable energy resources. Additionally, we support this bill because Senate Bill 554 facilitates greater coordination and technical information sharing among regulatory agencies. As has been mentioned previously, there is a need for streamlined development of new development opportunities. Doing so through the creation of this task force would help cement our reputation nationally as a leader in renewable energies. Failing to pursue planning will create unnecessary and costly impediments to the construction of new generation facilities and the transmission lines that are required by utilities. Overall, the efforts of the task force will serve to better inform future business decisions throughout the state and will thereby provide the certainty that renewable energy proponents so need if they are to continue providing a high return on investment to Oregon counties. The state of Oregon has benefited from a robust renewable energy industry sector. On Senate Bill 554 is a revenue-neutral measure that will ensure that the state continues to enjoy the renewable energy fruits that Oregon has been blessed with. The smart development of diverse renewable energy resources is essential for building a clean energy future that diminishes our reliance on volatile energy sources and helps us move away from costly and polluting fossil fuels. These are priorities that have been reinforced by Oregon lawmakers for over a decade, and we hope that you will continue to support economic opportunities for renewable development into the future. Finally, I'd like to thank Senator Edwards for your efforts on this bill and apologize that John Audley was not able to be here today to thank you personally and express his appreciation of working closely with you to create this bill. To the chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time. I appreciate you hearing this bill.
Ms. Lauren, are you familiar with the work that the Western governors did on the mapping resources?
Somewhat, yes.
I guess the question I have, and I appreciate the work the senator has done on this, but getting down to the real problem, the issue is the conflict between where most of the wind is, that desirable offsets, which tends to be in the southeastern corner mm-hmm. of the state, and where the grouse is. That's in the southeastern corner. I'm trying to get to what the result of this would be. We're going to get a report back, but it doesn't strike me that that moves us towards a resolution of the conflict between the two. And I wonder if there's a way we can do this that will get us more there. I'm not sure how to do that, because the work that the Western governors did was very, very detailed and ran into exactly this problem, unfortunately, almost in every state where the good renewable resource was, there was a major conflict with wildlife.
Thank you for your question, Mr. Chair. To that, I would say that the overall goals of this task force and the intention behind the bill is to not necessarily specifically address one species or type of habitat, but to rather provide guidance for overall planning within the state of Oregon. It takes these combination of maps and would create overlay areas that would be able to facilitate greater energy development of multiple technologies in one space, and then also it designates those areas in proximity to transmission lines. So it's not intended to overall resolve issues such as that those presented by the sage grouse, but would incorporate that into the planning. It's less of a specific siting bill than creating those broader categories of this is a suitable area for development. We would encourage it and help support projects and streamline their development within X space and have those throughout the state. I hope that answers your question.
Other questions?
No, but a comment to Senator Gerard's question earlier.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My boss has informed me that on page 3 of the bill, lines 2 through 4, you'll find that it does define the renewable resources, and those renewable resources are including but not limited to wind, solar, low-impact hydropower, tidal, wave, biomass, biofuel, ethanol, and geothermal resources.
Can I ask you to put cogeneration in there? That is renewable, and I have a timber district.
Biomass is included.
The new Secretary of State probably hasn't had an episode with conceptual amendments, so let's teach him. Let's put it in as a conceptual amendment.
Oh, that's not. That's not the violation of our rules. All right. Yes. That's all I have who have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this?
Sagegrass Freedom Foundation.
We do not have a fiscal on this, so we will close the public hearing, and we will move to Senate Bill, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 958.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 958 expands application requirements for dismantler certificate to include the applicant's National Motor Vehicle Title Information System Identification Number. It defines mobile motor vehicle crusher and crushed motor vehicle. It established requirements for use of mobile motor vehicle crushers by dismantlers and expands the authority of ODOT to impose sanctions. It authorizes ODOT to impose civil penalties for violations on persons who hold dismantler certificate. There's no revenue impact and there's minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Mr. Gallagher, why don't you come on up too? Mr. Fuller, would you like to start?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I want to say thank you to staff for making sure the bill was scheduled as quickly as it was. We certainly appreciate their work on that behalf. Senate Bill 958 makes three changes in statutes that regulate dismantlers. Dismantlers are the people that take cars at the end of their useful life, strip off all the useful parts, and then eventually end up crushing and shredding the leftovers so that they can be recycled and used again. The first change is in Section 1 of the bill, and it adds a requirement that dismantlers provide the DMV with their National Motor Vehicle Title Information System Identification Number when they apply or renew for their dismantler certificate. That number is important because it reports VIN numbers to a national database when a car is destroyed so that VIN number cannot be reused and indicates that the vehicle is no longer able to be used as a viable motor vehicle on the roads. The second part of the bill defines a crushed motor vehicle and a mobile motor vehicle crusher. And the circumstance, and then it creates sort of a regulatory environment for those mobile crushers. The circumstances we have are with small dismantlers. They can't always afford to have their own crusher, which is a very expensive piece of equipment. So a small dismantler will purchase vehicles and strip off all the useful parts that they can resell. And then when they get enough vehicles that they want to have them crushed and sold for scrap, they will subcontract out to get a mobile crusher to come in and crush those vehicles for them. There are a couple of different circumstances. In one circumstance, the mobile crusher is coming to a licensed dismantling facility. And the other example would be if a local government or the DEQ is cleaning up a piece of property where maybe somebody has been hoarding vehicles, and that is not a licensed dismantler location. And sometimes those local governments will hire a mobile crusher to come in and crush those vehicles to get them out as well. In the case where it's not a licensed location, the dismantler that owns the crushing unit is required to make sure that the vehicles being crushed are environmentally safe. They have to remove the mercury switches. They have to deploy the airbag. They have to drain all the fluids. They have to make sure that before they crush that vehicle that they're not going to spill anything onto the ground before they dispatch with the vehicle. In the case where a dismantler is subcontracting to bring in a mobile crusher because they can't have their own, you have a circumstance where both entities are licensed as a dismantler. So it was our decision crafted in the language that the dismantler that owns the vehicles and that is subcontracting to bring a crusher in, that that dismantler be responsible for making sure that that vehicle is environmentally prepared to be crushed. Now, that doesn't prevent that dismantler from subcontracting the responsibility of removing all that stuff to the mobile crushing unit. They can still contractually negotiate the work that's required to do that, but when it comes to liability, if it's not done, we believe that the person that owns the vehicles and that owns the dismantling business that's subcontracting ultimately should be responsible for what happens to their vehicles. And then the final part of the bill simply makes some changes to the penalty structure for dismantlers when they violate the law. Right now, it's a little goofy the way it's put up. If a dismantler violates one section, they can get a financial penalty, and if they violate another section, they can get a probation or a suspension, but the DMV doesn't have the authority to do one or the other. And so we made sure that everything is cross-referenced so that when DMV is issuing a penalty against a dismantler for violating the rules, that they have flexibility in deciding whether or not they want to use a civil penalty, whether they want to put them on probation or suspension, or whether they want to do a combination of those depending on the severity of the violations that they've had. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Can you explain kind of the genesis of the bill? And you had folks at a table kind of working together to put this together. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we had a work group during the interim. The DMV had discovered that mobile crushers were expected to be licensed or certified as dismantlers, but for them to go to a location that is not a dismantler location, again, the example I used where a local city or county would have somebody come in, they would have to get a supplemental certificate even if they were only going to be there for 1 or 2 days. And getting a supplemental certificate as a dismantler is a pretty long, involved process, and we didn't want a mobile dismantler to, or a mobile crusher to have to go through that process if they were only going to be at that location for 1 or 2 days, as long as they were following all of the dismantler statutes that we're required to have, that we would exempt them from that supplemental certificate requirement. So as we got some mobile crushers and some regular dismantlers and DMV in the room together, we looked at some other changes that needed to be made and you know, what we needed to do to make this process work effectively, and this is the work product that we came up with.
Any other questions? Mr. Gallagher.
Tom Gallagher, representing Snitzer Steel and Pick and Pull, which is a dismantler. We were not part of the work group and didn't know about this work group, so my questions are, having first discovered it on the bill here. I'm looking at on page 2, subsection C, and I've asked Mr. Fuller these questions, and I'm still not certain how this works, and I am certain that we have some interest in this from our position as a shredder. What we have here is, as I think you very aptly described, where you go to a site that does not have a dismantler's license compared to a site that does have a dismantler's license. Now, we've been operating a mobile shredder for some time that we've not had problems under the current law. I can understand that there's complications in it. So fixing that part that they did on subsection B on line 35 is of value to us, too. That's not a problem. But what, from the shredder's point of view, when we get a crushed car, if we do an inspection on it and we find that it hasn't been properly dismantled, that there are fluids in it, the tests in it, and so forth, or we don't discover that because the, you know, or the tests are not all that perfect, we end up with quite a problem with both in our processing with wastewater and so on with car. So what my discussion with Mr. Fuller was is on line 32, where you go to a location that has a dismantler's license. I'm not sure that I want to relieve the obligation of either of the parties that has a dismantler's license. If we take our shredder, which has a dismantler's license, and what that means basically on that part of it is that, and I think Daryl described it quite well, we're going to drain the fluids out of it, we're going to take out the mercury switches, we are going to dispose of the mercury switches, and some of this is kind of expensive work. So there are a number of ways in which somebody could save some costs here and save some money. And on the shredder end, we end up with somebody when they do that. So I think, and I would leave it to the committee, but I would like to see, I don't think there should be a difference between a licensed dismantler who runs a shredder who goes to an off-site location where they have to handle all the fluids and one that goes to a dismantler's location. Because if I'm going to a dismantler's location, which we do right now, we'll arrange by contract as to how we're going to handle that. Either I'm going to get a clean car, one that's completely stripped, and there'll be a price for that, or we're going to take the car as it is, and we're going to handle, in our mobile services, we're going to dismantle it, take all the fluids out and take all the parts out. Most likely, the dismantler's going to do that because he wants the parts. So most likely, we're going to get a clean car. And our position is, look, when we at the shredder get that car, we want both the crusher and the dismantler, both of whom have licenses and both of whom have obligations on this, to be responsible for that car if it's not cleaned. And I don't like the part where we're not sure which party has the liability for that when it goes through. Under the law, it would be shifted over to the dismantler. We get a dirty car, we would go back to the dismantler. I understand that. We don't understand why you need that change. So we're doing it now, and we think that there should be the same liability on the crusher regardless of where they go to the site at.
But, Tom, isn't the shredder protected in either case?
Not if it's not done. We're not protected if it's not done. And there's a reason why. With our shredder right now, this isn't a problem. We assume the responsibility. We do it by contract or however we do it with wherever we pick up the cars and wherever we do the mobile crushing at. We believe that this crusher who has a dismantler's license should not be relieved of the obligation of the dismantler's license by law.
But aren't you, I don't know your business, but aren't you, as a shredder, if you're buying the car, if it was crushed by a mobile crusher on the site, you don't have a contractual relationship with the crusher. You have a contractual relationship with the
right. The
car. And there's nothing in this that would appear to remove your ability for still contracting for that.
Mr. Chair, I think you're missing. It's not the contract between the shredder. It's the deal. If I go onto your property and I make an agreement with you to crush your car, you're going to pay me to crush your cars.
Right.
I have a dismantler's license. I don't think we should allow that crusher under his dismantler's license to be removed of the obligation of making sure those cars are clean.
This doesn't appear to do that.
I think it does on line 30, where you go to where you're using a mobile crusher at a location approved by the dismantler certificate. The dismantler who holds the dismantler certificate shall be responsible for complying with all the statutes. So the liability is shifted from the crusher to the dismantler.
Mr. Chair, if I might. And it's not exactly shifted because they already have it. They still have it under any circumstances. The person who owns the vehicle has liability for making sure that it's clean. What the bill does is if the person who owns the vehicle and has the dismantler's license subcontracts out the crushing portion of it, it eliminates the liability of the person who is acting as the mobile crusher because they are there as a subcontractor, not as a dismantler. They have a dismantler's license, but they are not the vehicle owner and they're not dismantling the vehicle. They're simply renting a piece of equipment that dismantler can't afford, so they're coming in as a subcontractor and simply destroying the vehicle. Now, we believe that there can be an agreement between the dismantler and the mobile crusher in terms of who's going to be responsible for cleaning the vehicle and making sure it's prepared before it gets crushed. So if the mobile crushing unit wants to make the extra money by removing all the stuff out of it, they can still do that by contract. But the vehicle then, once it is crushed and is sold to Schnitzer or wherever it is sold, it is sold by the dismantler, not by the mobile crusher. And that dismantler who owns the vehicle and is selling it to be shredded, they're the ones that need to represent that vehicle's cleaned and it was cleaned before it was crushed, and they're selling the product. So we believe ultimately they should be responsible for making sure that the vehicle's clean. Now, I had thought prior to this hearing, when I first learned of of Schnitzer's objections that maybe we could have an amendment for a task force, but I've since decided that maybe that's not such a good idea. We would prefer the bill just be passed as is.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, I just want to go back and say what Darrell said. I have both a DMV obligation and an environmental obligation under my dismantler certificate, and the crusher also has to have a dismantler certificate. I do not understand why by law the crusher should be eliminated from following those restrictions. I'm sure they can be done by somebody else. I'm sure all they have to do is check them, and I'm sure that will be replaced in the price. It would be suspicious to say that there's a reason why somebody wants to be relieved of the liability here, and I would never suggest that it had to do with the price and the cost and business practices in the field, but this is an area which there is a lot of liability for the environmental problems, and that's the concern that we have. We'd like to have all the people who are licensed dismantlers to be on the hook for making sure that vehicle is clean.
Tom, I'm trying to follow through on this. In line 25, we're speaking of the dismantler, which would be the business or the person whom Schnitzer would, or the shredder, would buy the vehicle from, right, to shred. So if I'm reading this, if I'm understanding this correctly, your relationship is with the dismantler who may hire somebody else to bring in a mobile crusher.
That's right.
So it would strike me that who is still responsible here is the dismantler, who would be the one that, if something arose, you would fall back on for liability. They're the ones who are liable, and they're just purchasing the service, the purchase being crushing the vehicle.
That's, Mr. Chair, that's true. The problem with environmental liability is absolute liability. Once you have it on your property, you get it. And what the dismantler certificate here has laid out for it is a set of obligation that dismantler is charged with by DMV and inspected for by DMV to make sure they have all of the equipment, all the knowledge, and all the tools to strip the cars. And it's right that the crusher has the dismantler's license, because they could be going to a state fairground picking up free cars or you know, something like that, where they would be where there's no dismantler and nobody who has the license and the obligation to clean that car. So that's what a non-dismantler site is. So that's why the crusher has to have the dismantler obligations and all the duties and responsibilities attached to that. I just don't understand, as a matter of law, why we would by law shift the liability from one dismantler to another. And there has to be some reason why that's in there, and I don't know what that reason is, because that crusher, as a dismantler, has the legal obligation to clean that car. They have that, and by what you're doing in the statute would say they no longer have it when they do it at a licensed dismantler. Why?
Mr. Chair, if I might, and part of the discussion we had in crafting the bill the way we did is, when you have a joint liability like that, where a vehicle is supposed to have been stripped clean and wasn't, and you had a mobile crusher in, our concern was that you would have the dismantler who owned the vehicle saying, well, I told the crusher to do it, and the crusher saying, well, the vehicle belonged to the dismantler. We assumed they had done it. And then you end up with a whole lot of time and a lot of effort and perhaps a lot of litigation, when it made more sense to us as a matter of law that the person who owns the vehicle and that owns the dismantler business ought to be responsible for making sure that car is clean, because it's their vehicle. Now, if they want to contractually give that responsibility, the work of that responsibility, to the mobile crusher, they can have the mobile crusher remove all of that stuff and get it ready to go, but the person who owns that vehicle, before it get crushed, they ought to have the responsibility to make sure the vehicle is clean and ready to go.
Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gallagher, I'm just a little confused. It seemed to me that your client, Schnitzer Steel, would benefit under the change in the statute. Aren't you, to a certain extent, arguing against the interest of your client by saying that the owner of the vehicle, which may or may not be your client, would be the ones ultimately responsible for abiding by the rules and regulations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, on the face of it, you would think that would be the obvious answer. So let's go to the next question as to why we think that's a problem. And the reason we think it's a problem, because if I go to a dismantler and they don't do the job, they just strip out the good parts and they leave the car, and I go in and I crush it, because that's all I was contracted to do, and I don't have any obligation to check it out, and I deliver it to the shredder, and the shredder starts to cut it up and finds out in their testing that, oops, it's not done. And we're doing it now. Right now, we are out there assuming the responsibility, regardless of our contractual relationship, to make sure the car's clean. And we're doing it. So we're saying to our people, well, do you want to just be able to transfer that over to somebody else? And they say, well, no, why would we do that? We can think of a number of reasons why people might want that to be in there, but none of those reasons seem to me to be good business reasons.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for this taking up so much time. If I own a small dismantling business and I have a bunch of cars I want to have crushed, I'll bring in a mobile crusher, and they will crush those vehicles, and the mobile crusher then leaves. Their responsibility is over. I will have those vehicles then loaded onto a trailer or a truck and take them to Schnitzer, or Schnitzer will come pick them up. The mobile crusher is no longer part of that equation. They came in as a subcontractor and simply provided a crushing service. Okay. If those vehicles that I as a dismantler own and sell to Schnitzer are not cleaned up the way they should have been, Schnitzer's not going to know if it was a mobile crusher that crushed them, or when they were crushed, or how they were crushed. Schnitzer's just going to know they bought them from me, and they're going to assume that I should be responsible for making sure that those vehicles that I sell to them are clean vehicles. And that's what we think the statutory policy ought to be. The person that owns the vehicle and sells the vehicles ought to be responsible for making sure that they're clean. How they crushed them, whether it was a subcontractor that came in 2 days ago or 2 months ago to do it, doesn't have anything to do with Schnitzer, because they were simply somebody that was hired as a subcontractor to provide a service. So they're not in the transaction between the dismantler and the place that we sell them for scrap, because the person that's buying them from scrap doesn't care how they were crushed or who they were crushed by. They only care who they bought them from, and that's the person that we believe should have the liability.
Well, Mr. Fuller, this is getting to be a little more complicated than I thought it was, so I think maybe we're going to think about this one a little bit.
Okay.
And perhaps you and Mr. Gallagher can get together and see if you can work out an amendment that makes you both happy. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this bill, Senate Bill 958? Matt, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 958. We have one more. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 802. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 802 authorizes Director of Corporation to consider short-term and long-term interests in determining the best interest of the corporation. It allows the Director to evaluate the best interest of a corporation when assessing proposals on merger, consolidation, or purchase of the corporation. There's no revenue impact, but I have not yet received a fiscal impact.
Okay, so I have Jeff Wilson, Andrew Morrow, James Kennedy, and after that, Dick Roy. Whoever wants to go first.
Well, I will go first. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for taking up this hearing on Senate Bill 802. My name is Jeff Wolfstone. I'm a practicing corporate lawyer from Portland. I work at the firm of Lane Paul PC. I've practiced over 30 years, worked on some law improvement projects, including chairing the task force, maybe that's a bad word today, but the task force that prepared and led to the adoption of the current Oregon Nonprofit Corporation Act, which has been in place for since the late 80s. Some time ago, Dick Roy, who's behind us here, who will talk after we finish up, convened some corporate lawyers to talk about ways that we might improve the Oregon Business Corporation Act. And we came together, we prepared a draft, which is in this bill. We vetted it with leading corporate lawyers in Portland, and bring it forward today. The bill, in its essence, is quite simple. The existing provisions of the Nonprofit Corporation Act dealing with so-called other constituencies, and if you look at the existing provision, which is italicized, it's under paragraph 5, includes social, legal, and economic effects on employees, customers, and suppliers of the corporation, and on the communities and geographical areas in which the corporation and its subsidiaries operate, the economy of the state and nation, long-term as well as short-term interests of the corporation and its shareholders. Those are all factors, interests of other constituents that a corporation currently expressly can take into account when the board is looking at a takeover proposal. What our Bill 802 does, it extends clearly the authority to take into account those interests in everyday decision-making of the corporation. We know that the current act simply does not expressly provide for it, but impliedly allows for it, and so the purpose here is to clarify and to bring this provision into conformity with a growing trend in other states across the country.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Morrow. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland.
Thank you for being so plural. It's vice chair and member, but
it makes it sound vice chair Atkinson
and member, yeah.
Senator Gerard.
Thank you.
Oh man,
I'm sorry.
To sound much bigger.
No. Yes. Protocol. I've been in practice in corporate law for 30 years, also practice at Lane Powell. I've been a past chair of the Oregon State Bar Business Law Section and served as its legislative chair for a number of sessions and have appeared before the legislature in connection with changes to the Business Corporation Act for more than 20 years. I'm appearing today to express my own views, not those of any other organization, but also to refer you to the written testimony of Judd Schneerson, who I think was provided to you. Professor Schneerson is now a law professor at Hofstra, but previously taught law at the University of Oregon and has researched and written extensively on corporate issues, including the business judgment rule. Very briefly, the reasons for making this change. There are 33 states that have these kinds of other constituency statutes. About 11 of them, like Oregon, are limited to takeover situations. The other two-thirds of those statutes are not so limited and would be consistent with what we are proposing here. As Jeff mentioned, our view is that the current law would support taking these various factors into account in making any kind of corporate decision making, but the case law in Oregon on this subject is pretty sparse. The statute in its current form is limited to takeover situations. So we're recommending this change to clarify and to the extent it to provide some comfort to directors that, in fact, they can take these factors into account in making all of their decisions. It also helps to get away from the common misconception that corporate boards have a legal obligation to maximize shareholder profits and not take into account other factors. Professor Schneerson has written extensively on this, and there is a reference to one of his articles in the written testimony at the end. The third factor is just to encourage directors to look at these issues and to take them into account. And finally, as I mentioned, to take the Oregon law and put it more consistently with the other constituency statutes in other states. I'll stop there. And
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Kennedy. I'm an attorney practicing in Portland. I also have been involved in a lot in the drafting of many of the corporate and business entity statutes. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 802. I was a member of the drafting committee. These types of statutes that are referred to, that are
these types of provisions that are included in the bill are generically referred to as other constituency statutes because they address the constituencies other than shareholders. There really is no need to include shareholders as a constituency in the provisions of the bill because the interests of the shareholders are implicit in all the decisions that the board makes as to what are in the best interests of the corporation. In light of the hour, I will be very brief. A lot of my testimony is in the written testimony provided to you. But all of the provisions of the bill come from other well-recognized sources. All of the other constituencies and factors come from many of the other corporate statutes in other states. They also come from the existing statute, which, as Mr. Morrow indicated, applies only to acquisition transactions. The only exception to this is subparagraph A on lines 6 and 7 of page 2, which comes from the American Law Institute's Principles of Corporate Governance, which is the ALI's attempt to restate corporate law. I would like to close by just noting that there is nothing in this bill that requires any of these considerations to be taken into account by the Board of Directors in making any corporate decisions. This is a permissive bill only. I would like to turn it over to Dick Roy, who has a few brief comments.
Okay. Mr. Roy.
Hey, I'm Dick Roy. I was a corporate lawyer at Stoll Reeves until 93, and then I left so my wife and I could be volunteers and work in the sustainability arena. And we've worked with businesses and individuals since that time on voluntary practices. And if you kind of to put this in context, back in 1987, three of us were involved in a complete rewrite of the Business Corporation Act. It has not been rewritten since 1987. In 1989, the provision that we're talking about today was actually drafted by my members of my old law firm, Stoll Reeves, and it was in connection with a proposed takeover, I think, of Precision Castparts. Since 1989, there's been a huge transition, both societally and in business, in terms of the concept of sustainability. For example, corporate social responsibility, sustainability was not really in the late 80s a concept that was talked about or in vogue. Today, many corporations state that they're operating under the triple bottom line of sustainability, and that's kind of it's a statewide goal, it's a business summit goal, it's really a goal of the state. This change, which is somewhat technical, kind of corporate lawyers kind of change, simply takes the provision, the other constituency provision, and makes it clear that on a permissive basis only, that these matters can be considered by a board of directors. And in a way broadens the perception of discretion, although it's probably there, not yet defined by the courts at this time, so it allows directors to feel more comfortable in making these considerations that they're making at this time anyway. Questions?
Thank you. Would you like this back? Questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you for enduring 2 hours and 11 minutes of our hearing. We thank you very much for coming.
I do have one.
Mr. Chair?
So in essence, what this allows is that it would allow a board to, without violating their fiduciary responsibility, to take things other than economics into consideration?
Can I answer that? I'll take that. Okay. So they already can do that under the existing discretion that a board has. This is to make it explicit that if I go attend a board meeting and I'm advising a client and they're asking what can we take into account when we make this decision whether to go left or go right, can I look at anything else other than what is in the immediate bottom line interest of the company? And the answer is yes, you can. What this does is it makes it clear that you can look at all these other factors, and here it is in the statute.
It's just adding a pair of suspenders to the belt.
Correct.
It is, and the Oregon courts have not don't have a very explicit definition of the business judgment that directors have. This makes it clear that it's a broad discretion that directors have in making decisions.
Okay. I got a question. Is there any documented cases where this is a problem, or is this a solution looking for a problem?
I'll take a run at that. Well, it in a state like Delaware, for example, which has a business court, a court of chancery, which regularly and in great depth looks at their corporate statutes and interprets them on a regular basis, there's a lot more guidance. In a place like Oregon, we don't have a specialized business court. We're not here asking for one, obviously. And there's less clarity. We corporate lawyers think we know what it means. We will look at, you know, by reference to other states. But we think because quite a number of other states have found it appropriate to put this in place, that it's a good solution, and next time asked, it's a better answer to the board.
More?
Well, I just didn't get any examples in Oregon where this has become a problem. Is there any court cases? I know it's permissive, but it just seems like we're doing an awful lot here, but I don't see where the problem is.
We're making a living.
Senator Gerard, there are very few cases in Oregon dealing with business judgment rule. And for lawyers, it's somewhat frightening in terms of advising boards in view of these cases. Probably the most recent case that I can remember is one that came out of Eastern Oregon several years ago, the Colvin case. And in that case, the business judgment rule was correctly articulated, but it was, in my opinion and the opinion of others, misapplied to the facts of the case. So it is a real problem, and as Mr. Wolfstone indicated, it's much easier to incorporate in Delaware, where you have a large body of law where boards can feel more comfortable and lawyers can advise them with respect to what their duties are. And all this attempts to do is to clarify the business judgment rule so that Oregon corporations can act without fear with respect to the interests of other constituencies.
We also have special chancellery. I can't say the word. Business courts.
Chancery. I would add one thing, that one of the things that generated this bill getting started was one of our colleagues who does a lot of advising of business corporations and said, I'm uncomfortable about this. I'd like the statute to say this explicitly. And you know, when we have one of our colleagues who has that level of experience suggesting that it's an ambiguity, it becomes one that we think ought to be resolved.
And as a drafting committee, we've been very, very careful with respect to taking the provisions of this bill from other very well recognized sources.
Does this take the increase the likelihood that Oregon would be viewed as less of a Delaware-like place to start a business? Or to actually register a business would be more direct way.
Chair Beyer, I think that the you know, if anything, this might assist somebody in making the decision to stay in Oregon. I think that the corporations which tend to be incorporated in Delaware tend to be corporations that are going to be incorporated there regardless, because of the factors that influence them are particularly financing related. And when capitalists and other kinds of financing sources dictate that, they generally look to Delaware for that reason. We're trying to make it attractive to our own corporations, and particularly the smaller ones, to stay here.
Hmm. Oh, sure.
I want to take a shot at this. I'm sorry. No, honestly, I've been reading through all these things. And it seems, okay, here's my take on it, and correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, this protects the director, say, from a minority stockholder, from a decision that was made by the director that would not necessarily have positive financial returns. Is that kind of, am I looking at that correctly?
That is the law right now. The American Law Institute and the principles of corporate governance have been quite clear that boards need to act in a responsible way with respect to the conduct of the business, but they can choose to act ethically even if it doesn't maximize profits or produce shareholder gain. That's what the case law is, but there's a general misconception among lawyers, businesses, and others that the law really is that corporations must maximize profits. That isn't the law, but it does have it. Those misconceptions have a very chilling effect on boards. Mm. That's one of the reasons for this bill is to dispel some of those misconceptions.
So just to follow, sorry, he wants to get out, and I probably should too. I really do try to understand these bills, and it seems to me like then you're not really making a policy change. This is more like what we would call a housekeeping bill. It just clarifies the language that is in existing Oregon law.
That is correct, but if somebody were looking to what existing Oregon law is, they would never find it in the statutes. Mm-hmm. And what this does is it puts the business judgment rule considerations that are applicable to boards in the statutory provision.
Okay, one final question. Mm-hmm. The fiduciary responsibility to the minority stockholders, that is what, you know, that seems like this is trying to undermine that part of the equation, and that, let's put it this way, I just lost money on the SunWest project, okay, and as a minority holder, some of those questions came into play. So how does this protect the minority stockholder from decisions that really have no bearing or are contraindicated to his financial benefit?
This does nothing to change the fiduciary duties the directors owe to shareholders. As Chair Beyer indicated, this is belt and suspenders. In Oregon, there is, and in all states, there's a business judgment rule. It's basically standard of judicial review. But it's not set forth in the statutes at all. In Oregon, we have the misfortune of having very few cases on the business judgment rule, and the cases are very difficult to reconcile.
I see what you're trying to do here, and I understand, I think, why you're trying to do it, but it strikes me that it potentially really clouds the job of a director in terms of its, where's their allegiance to the interest of the shareholders, as the senator was getting at, or to some broader societal goal?
Well, a director.
And if someone were going to challenge that, it's sort of like, on what basis? I mean, if someone were to challenge that the board had acted inappropriately, how would you defend as a director that you hadn't, that you had the interest of the shareholders at the top of your mind?
I mean, 21 others, well, 33 states have these other constituency provisions, and Oregon has one.
That just means that they all have the same problem we're talking about.
but a director's job, just like a legislator's, is really to balance competing interests. in the business judgment rule.
Yeah, but I can't protects, be sued for not acting prudently.
Yeah, but the business judgment rule does protect that decision-making because it prevents the courts from second-guessing the decisions of directors. And what we attempted to do in the written testimony is sort of describe the business judgment rule and why this is important. But I think going back, Mr. Chair, to your prior comment, I mean, this really is just belt and suspenders.
Yeah.
But in Oregon, we face a significant difficulty, really, because of the lack of case law.
You're wondering if your client gets in front of the court whether his pants are going to fall down. I get it. I think we understand it. I'm not sure how.
You got belt and suspenders, and I lost my drawers. So.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for bearing with us and staying with us this long.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Appreciate your work on behalf of citizens as well.
Thank you.
Let's see. Is there anybody else who wants to try anything today?
Are you going to allow me to change my vote?
Can't open a work session without a quorum.
Oh,
I screwed up, man.
All right.
We are adjourned.